I'm your host, David Nage. This is BaseLayer, where institutional investors come to learn about crypto.
The views, information, or opinions expressed during the BaseLayer podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of ARKA, where David Nage is a principal. ARKA is not responsible and does not verify the accuracy of any of the information contained in the podcast series available for listening. The primary purpose of this podcast series is to educate and inform. The podcast series does not constitute financial advice or other professional advice or services. Please do your own research.
Today's show is sponsored by Coinbase Prime, a leading prime brokerage for digital assets. While Coinbase is widely known for its retail business, Coinbase also provides the bridge to the digital asset world for institutional investors, high net worth individuals, financial institutions, and corporate investors. Through their professional trading platform, deep and diversified liquidity, execution expertise, and Coinbase custody, one of the largest, most trusted digital asset custodians, Coinbase Prime is a solution for institutions looking to enter the digital asset markets. For more information, visit prime.coinbase.com. This is David, and this is your new episode of BaseLayer. It is an honor and a privilege to have Raul Pal, the founder at Real Vision, with me today. Raul, how are you?
I'm great. I'm slightly overrated. It's not that much of an honor and a privilege, but I appreciate it.
It is an honor and a privilege. You are just a wealth of knowledge coming not just from the world of traditional assets, but now world in digital assets. And we're going to have a fantastic conversation here. And I want to jump right in there. If you don't know who Raul is, then I'm sorry if you don't know who Raul is, but we'll put show notes in there so you can find out about Real Vision and everything that Raul has been doing there, because it is basically the go-to place right now for institutional investors to learn not just about traditional markets, but it's becoming the go-to place for institutional investors to learn about digital assets. And so we'll make sure that everyone knows where to go for that. But I want to jump right in. This world is just, I'm expecting, you know, it's 2021. You know, we just had an insurrection basically here in the United States, you know, about 2 days ago. I'm expecting the aliens to come down anytime soon, because it just seems like whatever you think is not feasible and not possible is just happening now. So I want to address kind of the elephant in the room, is this insurrection. And so we saw, again, a group out there, a very large group, storm the U.S. Capitol while it was in service, while they were doing the work of the Constitution. And what we saw is nothing. The market did nothing. It actually went up. What, in your opinion, is happening here? Are we in a world of just fantasy land where the market is just waiting for its next hit of quantitative easing, of its free cash? What is going on out there?
I wish I had a clue. I mean, one thing I will know is almost all of us expected some sort of unrest going into the final stages of the transition of power. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, I mean, what transpired was very different than any of us imagined. Didn't imagine them to storm the government as it was, but the question really is what is driving this market? We know it's being driven by central bank liquidity, and we know it's being driven by passive investment flows. So basically, if nobody does anything in the market right now, the passive flows from 401ks are driving higher. So it's become disconnected from the macroeconomic setup that's there, but it leads itself to be extremely vulnerable should that flow change or stop. So I think Mike Green on Real Vision has talked a lot about this. There is a rising probability that we're going to have a high volatility event. Mm-hmm. Does that stop the market overall? No, because everybody knows the central banks come back in to try and protect it all, because the debt bubble is now so large and so pervasive and so global that nobody can allow it to burst. So it's a really complicated, weird old world out there, and it's slightly terrifying. When I see what's going on,
yep,
I think that the risks are building, and my big risk is, I think if Biden comes in, I think we're going to be heading towards 500,000 deaths in the US from COVID. He fought the election on it, regardless of whether you believe in lockdowns or not. Not my issue. He fought the election on it. Chances are they're going to have to lock down. We've seen it in the UK. We're seeing it in Germany. We're seeing it starting in Spain again. We're seeing it all over the world. If the US goes into lockdown, the market's going to go into meltdown.
And so let's go another layer deeper. So you and I both know that trillions have been printed, that, you know, the good old bank of the Federal Reserve has been there to backstop all of these issues here in the United States. But across the pond, it appears that a lot of that debt, a lot of the debt that sovereign nations have been effectively clamoring to put out there to pay for things, for their liabilities, has been bought up by local banks. And so you, of all people, probably know this better than anyone in terms of history, in terms of liquidity crises. What happens if, you know, you have a liquidity crisis? What happens if you can't pay that debt back? And some of that debt, a lot of that debt, is actually coming due in the next 12 months.
Well, I worry less about the government debt side of things for now. You know, I think the central banks have proven that this can go much further than we imagine. So yes, there is all of this government debt that's on the banks who need to carry higher reserves, but they have an open door to the ECB to monetize that debt again to raise cash. So they've got themselves a nice setup to give some sort of security to the banking sector. So I'm not sure that's the big problem. The big problem really ends up being, in an MMT world, the currency market. You know, can we see a dislocation in currencies? Well, right now we've seen the dollar weakening and weakening and weakening. There is a risk that if we have a risk-off event in the US, plus this massive printing that probably needs to come out of Europe and the UK and all these other places, that we see a very strong dollar rally. Now, whether the dollar continues its old uptrend or it's within this larger range, but a move of bond yields higher and the dollar higher is the death knell for everything in the short term. So that's really where my focus is. I don't see yet the conditions in place for a dislocation in Europe where everything falls apart. I think the ECB printing money, backstopping the system, continues the same old thing for the time being. We've seen it in Japan. You can go to hundreds of percent of GDP and it doesn't seem to affect anything yet.
And so I want to talk about yields a little bit more. So the yield on the 10-year here was right around 1.08 on Thursday morning. And it seems that increased fiscal spending would be financed through the sale of more treasury bonds and a supply surge that may expect to push prices down and yields up. So a combo of rising rates and mounting debt has a lot of people out there. And you talk to probably the most sophisticated investors out there in the world, like Paul Tudor Jones and Stanley Druckenmiller and others out there. They are all kind of getting to a consensus that this is not good for dollar. I know you just said that, you know, it seems that the dollar actually might rebound, but it seems that there's also another consensus out there that all of this printing and all of this manufactured kind of joy, if you will, is going to come at a price. And so that's why a lot of people seem to have been looking to Bitcoin as a salvage. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think that narrative is partly wrong and partly right. It's wrong because US people tend to be US centric. Mm-hmm. So they're like, the Fed's printing, the dollar's going down. That's not how the world works. It just is not provable that it works that way. What is more interesting is when you take in combination all of the G4 central bank balance sheets, so the ECB, the BOJ, the PBOC, and the Fed, look at those combined, and that gives you the supply of total fiat money in the market. Now, we've seen over the years that those particular trading blocks, large central banks, rotate with who's doing the most printing at any one time. When you just strip out who's doing what when and look at it en masse, and I did this by looking at a basket of 27 global currencies, excluding the US dollar versus gold, it works perfectly. So basically, the value of fiat money is going down. Mm-hmm. A harder game is the game to decide which fiat money versus which. That's actually more complicated. But the simple story of the value of fiat money is going down is clear to see. And that is really what Bitcoin is picking up, because Bitcoin is a truly global asset. Mm-hmm.
What is the relationship? Because, you know, obviously the Dow, as I mentioned before, in the SPX here in the United States during a coup, rebounded and actually set an all-time high. What is the relationship between the fiscal and monetary policies here in the United States and the U.S. equity markets? Because I think a lot of people are confused. You know, they are wondering if it's purely this that is causing this rally, that it's causing these new all-time highs, that it's causing companies like Amazon to reach all-time highs. What is the relationship between the type of fiscal and monetary policy here in the United States to the equity markets, if you can elaborate a little bit more?
Well, this is really interesting because basically everybody else is running similar policies. And it didn't push the markets in the same way. Mm-hmm. So it's very unique to the US. And we can say maybe it's the reserve standard, or whether it's to do with the psychology of US markets, mm-hmm. which tend to be more speculative by nature than others. You know, typically a European investor is a bondholder, and typically a US investor is an equity holder. You know, typically the ECB has managed the economy for bondholders. Typically the Fed has managed the economy for equity holders. So there is different behavioral mechanisms that go on. So the policy mix is what it is. We don't know the actual mechanism by which it drives markets.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, you can't take out the effect of the passive flows and indexation and how that is distorting so many flows. Because there's less and less active managers over time because they've all been destroyed.
Yep.
So we've seen that value versus growth and all of this stuff. So active management industry shrinking, the hedge fund industry shrinking, but the passive flows just go on and on and on. So it drives more and more money into this beast that has no relation to valuation.
Mm-hmm.
So the typical millennial piling money into their 401k, puts it via Vanguard, doesn't think about valuation because they've just been told buy stocks. And index funds are the cheapest way of doing it.
Right.
So it's just there's so many distortions going on that it's really, really complicated. It feels to me somewhere that we're brewing for a bigger event again.
Mm.
It just feels like the disconnection is real. And it's going to take something exogenous to do it.
Right.
To stop those flows. What the exogenous event? I think it's a lockdown.
Yep, COVID rears its ugly head again. And I actually, early in 2020, I noticed that I felt personally that the market was in complete dislocation. You know, you had China go into a lockdown, which was effectively 19% of GDP going into a lockdown, and the market was just humming along. The VIX was about 13 or 14. Everyone was thinking that they were, you know, immune to this, that it was just a China issue. And then all of a sudden we have a global pandemic and the markets go into complete capitulation. So I agree. You know, it is worthwhile for anyone who's listening to this, do some analysis, do some scenario analysis if you don't already, do some stress testing. Think about some things that to you yourself think are completely improbable. Things that just you can't even fathom and just actually, you know, think about the probability. It's just, we're in a world right now where the improbable can really affect you quite negatively. And so
we've been in a long time in a market where this one standard deviation world, i.e. kind of mean reversion, mm-hmm. everything's normal, lasted for a long time. And then, you know, February, March last year, everything changed.
Yep.
And I think people wildly underpriced some of these more ridiculous outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's crucial. I mean, we're talking about Bitcoin, you know, I think people are going to wildly underprice the upside, the mm-hmm. speed of the upside, and also what correction comes. You know, there will be a correction in the middle of this, and it'll probably in the middle of a liquidation event of other assets, and it's going to take people by surprise. People need to be understanding of, okay, the market is taking a very big risk right now. It's all in on this kind of reflation trade, and Bitcoin is part of that. It's, you know, Bitcoin has other narratives too that are stronger, but we saw it in March last year. It got hit. So, you know, as you said, don't just assume that Bitcoin will decouple. Don't assume that because everybody thinks that the dollar is going to get weaker, that it will weaken. Maybe it strengthens 10% in a month.
Right.
You know, these are the kind of markets we're in. If the dollar strengthens 10% a month, maybe rates, maybe 10-year rates get to 120. Okay, then we've got a real problem for a lot of assets. So just be very cautious out there and understand the risks you're running.
So let's get into deeper onto Bitcoin. as for those that are not familiar, Raul and many of those around Raul have been doing a hell of a job educating people about this world of Bitcoin and digital assets. And so today we have seen Bitcoin eclipse 40,000. 41,000, it's currently somewhere around that range as we talk right now. And so for those that are listening that are still on the sidelines, and we know between you and I plenty of those that are still on the sidelines, however, that number slowly gets lower and lower daily. Two things. What are the conversations you're having with people out there that have started to look at this seriously? How has the calculus changed from the last year or two where they've actually started to take this seriously? And two, for those that you are talking to that are still on the sidelines, is it because now it's at $41,000? Do they think they've missed it?
No. The people on this, everybody is looking at it because price eventually forces everybody in. That's what I talked about, the supermassive black hole. If Bitcoin starts massively outperforming every other asset class, then you owe it to your investors to invest in the strongest asset, mm-hmm. right? That's how markets work. And that's true of pension funds. It's true of hedge funds. It's true of individuals. So, you know, it becomes a reflexive cycle where the more people get in, the larger the market cap goes, the larger the market cap is, the more it pushes larger institutional investors in, which pushes the market cap up, which pushes the price, you know, ad infinitum until it collapses again. You know, that's a very typical reflective loop that was made famous by George Soros. Mm-hmm. If people are interested in that, read Soros on Soros. It's probably the best book on describing how that reflexivity works. And we're in the largest reflective cycle I've ever seen. So that's what's dragging people in. People understand the simple narrative of hard money, money printing, right? That's basically the entire narrative. Mm-hmm. So it's basically golden digital age. Everybody understands that simple narrative. That's why Bitcoin has done well now, because it's managed to collate itself into one narrative. That's obviously not the entire narrative of Bitcoin, but that's the one that sticks to get institutions across the line. So who are the people who don't do it? The issue is it's a 69 volt asset. Mm-hmm. This is a big problem. I'm talking to, you know, a giant Italian family office that that I know very well, and they've got a decent amount of Bitcoin, and you know, the principal is in his 80s. He likes risk. But it's very hard to get his team to allow him to take the kind of risk that I would take in this. And he doesn't need to. He's rich and right. He's no spring chicken anymore. But still, the point being is, but he loves risk. Mm-hmm. The point being is his team won't allow it because it's a 65 volt, 70 volt asset. Mm-hmm. Now, what I explained to his team is that the distribution of returns is skewed to the upside, which makes it very different. So it's not a normally distributed asset right now. We'll do over time as we get to price discovery phase, mm-hmm. but it's a non-normal distribution asset. So there is a fatter tail on the upside. But people don't understand that necessarily. So it's difficult for institutions to do it. Right. Additionally, I've talked ad nauseum about the ridiculous narratives that go on in the space and the maximalism and you know, philosophies and all of this stuff.
Selling points.
Yeah, which only scare off institutions.
Yep.
What they want to know, portfolio diversification effects, portfolio enhancement effects, how it fits into their portfolio. That's it. They don't want to hear any of this other stuff. It's just not for them. It's for people like Michael Saylor, who believes in the philosophy, and that's great. We all have our anchors, why we anchor onto something. But trust me, to get the Ohio teachers' pension fund into Bitcoin, it's not going to be about this. It's going to be about portfolio diversification and how it's going to help their massive pension fund black hole that they've got with an aging population and a bad return profile.
And you've said it so eloquently, you have to talk their language. And so many of our friends or peers in the space that have not come from the backgrounds that you and I have, they don't get that. They talk about shelling points. They talk about all these different types of, you know, macro philosophers out there with their specific points. And they don't really want to talk about that. They want to talk about risk. They want to talk about return. They want to see if it's an asset that they could custody, which obviously today has been enhanced better than anything in its history. So you have more qualified custodians out there that are regulated. And so the infrastructure around it has been supported and has met this amazing inflection point. You know, you and I don't know if you appreciate it. I think you can. But, you know, when we talk about it as a team on our side, we thought that these types of catalysts or these types of sentiment shifts would take another 5+ years. But obviously, we had a massive global pandemic and the world changed, as you alluded to, in March. And so you had this kind of mixture of, you know, abnormalities that kind of came together that created this kind of wave where you had the world opening up, you know, their eyes to what's happening in terms of fiscal and monetary policy and everything that's at bay. And then you also had the infrastructure that was over the last few years building up to this point and was able to support the interest. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely right. It was right place, right time. And the halving cycle came just at the right time.
Yep.
With a global pandemic. And as you said, people like Fidelity able to custody for institution, game changing.
And so I want to talk beyond Bitcoin. And I love it that you have been fielding the folks out there who have criticized, you know, you and I and my team, and you know that we believe that there is an asset class here now, that Bitcoin is the money. Part of the asset class. It is programmable money. It is a store of value. It is effectively, in some people's opinions, a replacement to legacy gold. But beyond Bitcoin, there is a world. There is what I would say, we are explorers by nature. We look at technology. We look at what we've built so far, and we say, how much can we push it? What can we do with it? What are the boundaries? We don't build a computer and say, okay, that's it. We build a computer, and then we go to the moon, you know, literally. You know, those are the kind of things that we do. And so, you know, Bitcoin has been with us now for over 11 years after 30+ years of cryptographic work and research, but it came with an architecture that has lent itself to a furthering asset class and a furthering utilization beyond money. And so I would love for you to opine a little bit about DeFi specifically. So you know the fixed income market better than most, because obviously as a global macro strategist and someone who's been an investor for decades, you know that market. That market represents roughly about $100 trillion. And what we've seen, in my opinion, with DeFi is the next loop, the next iteration of fixed income, because with DeFi, you have lending, borrowing, collateralization, and yield with staking. Talk to us about what you're thinking about that from 2021 and beyond with DeFi and the world beyond Bitcoin.
Well, DeFi is a number of different things. At a macro level, it's interesting because it's, and I've talked about this a lot, it's starting to define a yield curve for crypto. Mm-hmm. Now, yield curves, whether people in crypto like it or not, all the yield curves are arbitraged down to the government bond yield curve. So it is not a decoupled yield curve, but maybe it gets fairer pricing of money. So, you know, right now, corporate credit is basically backstopped by the Fed, and it's very, very tight. So we will see higher yields in crypto for the time being. And that's great. It gives a different opportunity to drive yield. But if you drive more money into the space, yields will go down. That's just a factor of how it plays. But what we don't yet have is a long-term yield curve. So if we've got this long-term money, we don't have a long-term bond market. So DeFi is essentially a short-term money market. What we need is the whole yield curve, because then you can decide what you want to do with your Bitcoin, what the future expected value of Bitcoin is, all of that. We don't have any of this yet. Mm-hmm. So it's still very, very early. Yes, we can use the futures curve, but that's not very long-term either. So we don't have the long-term value of money. Without the long-term value of money, we don't have a relative valuation of asset classes. So that all has to come. So DeFi is interesting. It's very nascent. It's a wild west. It's all being tested. And I don't think it will get solved on this cycle. I think by the next time we come around, people will have got their heads together on how to make this actually work effectively over the long term with less risk. Right now, nobody even understands the risk they're running in DeFi. So it's experimental phase. And that's good. I mean, the space is about that. But you have to have your eyes open. This is not a market for widows and orphans. This is a market to be very cautious, learn, understand, help develop. Right. But eventually we will see proper structural yield curves for all of the digital asset space. And that will allow us to price all sorts of things And that's very important for the future of the space entirely. You know, because, for example, if we're starting to tokenize real estate, well, if it's a long-term play, we need to know what the expected future, you know, the kind of discounted cash flow or, mm-hmm. or the discount model that you use, and you can't do that right now. So there's so many things. If Bitcoin is going to be used as collateral, well, then we need to know the value of that collateral over time. And it's not about price. So, you know, we are nowhere near having set up a financial infrastructure yet. But we are working, you know, there's a lot of people working on it. It's coming.
Right.
But, you know, it's, and that's what's fascinating about this space. If it was all there, people like you guys wouldn't have the opportunity to invest in it.
Yep.
What the opportunity is you're bringing this entirely new asset class, of which it's very risky, with mm-hmm. high rewards. So it requires deep homework, yep. a bit of luck, good quality portfolio construction, and a time horizon that is longer than the short-term pump and dump that there's kind of implicitly built into a market, a VC market, which trades from day one.
Right.
And that's another thing people need to understand is these tokens, this is VC, but with real-time mark-to-market. Now, if you'd have had a real-time mark-to-market on Real Vision, they'd have been worth pretty close to zero about six times. And everyone would say, it's a scam, you know, and then you issue more shares. They're pumping and dumping. No, it's just how... it's just how startups work.
Mm-hmm.
What you need is time horizon.
Yep.
And mark to market is actually not good. So what happens is you announce this cool new project, the coins go up, then the original holders of the coins and the founders think, oh, this has gone way too far. This is like 10 years worth of growth priced in. I'll sell some. Coins go down. Everyone shouts it's a pump and dump. But over time, if the project's good, it'll find a base. It'll grow. They get the adoption. Their business grows and those tokens will be worth something, which is why I'm always super interested in what you guys are doing at Arca, because all of this is the future of everything.
And thank you for that. I want to get your opinion on this because, again, you have been an outspoken advocate for the understanding that this is an asset class and there is assets beyond Bitcoin. And I credit you for that. I obviously have told you many times I am supportive of that because I agree with you. I've seen this over the last 5+ years as an evolution. And again, as I said, as humans, we are explorers. We push the boundaries of technology. And just to rely on one single asset, one single, you know, beautiful thing that has been built is just, you know, not who we are as humans. And so I would love you to discuss, you and I talked about this a little bit offline, kind of the approach of second level thinking. Now, there's been people like Howard Marks and Ray Dalio out there that have used this notion of second level, third level thinking, where one would say, you know, there is a consensus that XYZ is a scam. And that is a common term thrown around within the digital asset landscape, especially on good old crypto Twitter. And you have people claiming this is a scam, that's a scam, that's a proverbial, and I'm going to apologize for the language, a shitcoin. And it's for people who actually have not done any of their diligence and really have not done any of the homework on any of those types of things. But you are out there using what classical, some of the best classically well-known founded investors use is second-level thinking. If everyone tells me that this is crap, I'm actually going to do some homework on it. How do you do that? How do you get to that mindset? Because a lot of people out there would say, oh, it's crap. But it's not an easy thing to do where you have to basically say, okay, those people have biases. I'm going to actually do the homework. How do you do that?
So the key here is to understand the biases, right? I spend a lot of time listening to these voices and trying to figure out what they're all about. So I'm going to give you a story first, and then I'm going to go into the crypto story. So a few years ago, I randomly, by mistake, got dragged into climate change denial Twitter. And it exploded. And I was asking people a very simple question is why do you guys not take Pascal's dilemma? Which is the fact that, you know, is if climate change is real and you don't take evasive action, it's catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
If climate change isn't real and you take evasive action, you only have an improved environment with relatively little cost.
Mm-hmm.
why would you run the risk of a catastrophe versus almost no downside?
Right.
So I asked that, and obviously people didn't really get what I was getting at. And when it came down to it, it came down to two things. The behavior of that group generally, not everybody, was because they didn't want their taxes to go up and because they didn't want their gas prices to go up. Mm-hmm. And so I pulled aside a few of these people and I realized that what was actually going on was the fact that they were financially burdened. Mm-hmm. And we're terrified of being more financially burdened. And I've written a lot about this, about wage deflation over the last 40 years. It's a very little discussed issue, the relative wage deflation over 40 years. And that's one of the reasons I think we're dealing with the political situation we're in now and a whole bunch of other issues. Mm-hmm. So that really helped me understand, okay, why were they saying this? It wasn't because they were stupid and didn't understand Pascal's dilemma. It wasn't because they really wanted to be conspiracy theorists. It wasn't because of anything else. It's because they couldn't take the bet. Mm-hmm. That was fascinating to me, right? They couldn't take any downside to their own personal finance. So, Bitcoin, why does it attract maximalism? Well, very simply, going back to 2007, a guy called Daniel Kahneman, mm-hmm. the forefather of behavioral economics, went to Silicon Valley and he had some lectures with everybody from, I think it was Elon Musk through to the founders of Google through to Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, they were all there. And he said, listen, you've got massive amounts of data. This is how you can affect human behavior to generate outcomes. Mm-hmm. And basically that changed everything. So they all went away and built behavioral stuff into their platforms, whether it's Google's algorithm to serve you more of what you want, or whether it's Facebook's like function and how the algorithm of their feed works. Mm-hmm. Almost everything, Twitter, everything is built up on that.
Yep.
So that was a big thing. The other thing was Metcalfe's law, mm-hmm. and network effects. So this became also Silicon Valley mainstream usage, which meant that if you could create a network with more connections, essentially it was worth more money, mm-hmm. at a specific level. And that's what Facebook did. And they became obscenely rich. Okay, so those two things collided because they used the behavioral economics to drive the network effects. Fabulous. Share prices went up, founders got rich, unicorns, blah, blah, blah. We mm-hmm. know the story. Then comes along Bitcoin, 2009. This is the greatest behavioral economics experiment of all time. Because unlike Facebook, there's two differences to Facebook. One is Facebook is about triggering emotion. When Bitcoin triggers money. Mm-hmm. So every time you persuade somebody to join the network, in Facebook, you get functionality. I can contact David on Facebook now and mm-hmm. say, hi, and here's what I'm up to, or Instagram, or whatever it may be. In Bitcoin, if you bring somebody into the network goes up in value. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have immense behavioral incentives. So in that world, if you're going to get richer by people bringing people into your network, much like the Catholic Church as well, in fact, most religions, mm-hmm. power, money, similar things, the more people you can bring into them, the better it gets for you and the richer you'll get personally. So you will defend your network against everybody else. Hmm. So therefore, you have to assume everything is a shitcoin and everything is a scam. Because then you have a probability of driving some of those people into your network. If you do, you increase the value of your network. So that is why this is the most powerful thing I've seen and why it has a very high chance of continuing this journey of mass adoption. Because it's almost impossible not to, because we're humans and we're fundamentally flawed. And if we see an opportunity to get rich by persuading other people to join us, we will do it. that's the basis of Ponzi schemes. It's the basis of all markets. But this one, because in Facebook, the other difference is the shareholders and the users were two different people. Mm-hmm. In Bitcoin, they're the same. Everybody's interest is aligned. Incredible. So this is why tribalism exists in the space. It's a feature and a bug.
Yep.
It's a bug because it's bloody irritating. Yes. Because it's actually just a much larger space than all of that. It's a feature because it creates robust networks. And yep. So that it is what it is. Now, as investors, we just need to understand why people are behaving as they are. And as investors, we then look for, okay, what are the opportunities because of that narrative? Because there will be. Mm-hmm. There are people who don't understand or don't want to touch Ethereum or, I mean, the whole XRP thing. Again, mm-hmm. I don't really care what anybody thinks about XRP, but I do know if everybody thinks it's terrible and we've got a very interesting event, special situation event. And mm-hmm. I'm a macro guy, special sits. We make our bread and butter living in those.
Yep.
Here's a special sit where, okay, if they lose the case to the SEC mm-hmm. and Ripple gets shut down, everybody ends up getting massively fined.
Yep.
XRP still exists, but it's traded outside the US.
Mm-hmm.
What's its value? What's its value? Maybe down 50% from here.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 75%. Okay, call it 5 cents. It's its mm-hmm. value. What happens if the SEC says, listen, guys, it was a security when you started. You guys broke the rules then. You're going to have to pay a price. You're going to get fined or you're going to get banned from the industry or whatever it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we understand that now it's more distributed and XRP is now not a security.
Right.
Because the pre-mining, that's an irrelevant thing because it mm-hmm. doesn't look like Bitcoin. It lets everybody. It's nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. So the upside then is probably 100x because we've actually got use cases in XRP.
Right.
So what you've got is a 50% downside, 100% upside. That's a 200-for-1 risk reward. I'll take that bet all day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I haven't done it yet. But this is how the market doesn't think because they're yep. driven by their own network effect narrative that they need to drive their own network. But as investors, we can take advantage of these things.
Yep.
Now, there is another one I'm kind of jumping the gun because I've just released my Global Macro Investor paper and you're getting the heads up on this ahead of everybody else. I'm not
planning
on television yet.
Good deal.
But there is a thought process that only Bitcoin has a Metcalfe's Law network effect
mm-hmm.
and that everything else is a utility token that's worth nothing more than water, i.e. the input costs.
Mm-hmm.
But I pretty much proven in the paper that they're all Metcalfe's law. They're all identical. Mm-hmm. So much so that I put it on Twitter. So much so that Ethereum is identical in price, number of wallet uses, and market cap to where Bitcoin was
mm-hmm.
at the same point. So when they both had a million active users, They're both trading at the same price.
Right.
They both look identical in market structure. They're both driven by Metcalfe's law.
Right.
It's not to refute anything to do with stock to flow or anything else. It's all part of the same thing. But it's a network and it's the network of money. We all know this.
Right.
And people will broaden out in risk profile into other parts of the space. And if you understand the risk that you're taking, you can get outsized returns, which is basically the definition of the ARCA business model, is once you look beyond, you can find risk-reward opportunities. And that is truly right. It's not easy. Ethereum is relatively easy because we know it has size and we know we can have a long-term time horizon mm-hmm. within that. It's not like it's a DeFi project that launched last week where we don't have long-term time horizons. So it's super, super interesting that the network effect applies to everything. It'll apply to Cardano. It'll apply to everything. Now, all of these work on S-curves. So an S-curve is how startups work, is you have mm-hmm. this kind of, you know, you try and figure shit out, then everything works for a bit, then it peters out, and you need to make that decision is, how do we move forwards, right, or are we going to fail? Right. That Bitcoin's gone through 100 of these. Mount mm-hmm. Gox, through to regulation, through to you name it. And it'll go through more. You know, maybe Tether's one of these S-curve moments. And Ethereum had its existential crisis. And XRP is going through its right now. And Cardano will go through it. They'll all go through it. That's the S-curve. Some of them won't survive. And some of them will. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes great alpha. And as I've said for a long time, there's more alpha in this space than anywhere else we've ever seen, because there's not enough money and it's very complex.
Yes. And I want to just underscore that what Raul is saying right now would be salacious and would be criticized to those that have lack of experience and foresight and the ability to understand these assets and these networks.
Well, like he's, but David, I think to say that is kind of, I know I do it as well.
Yep.
But we should not be judgmental. They're trying to protect their network.
Yep.
So what we say is, we understand that those guys want to protect their network.
Yep.
But we assess the probabilities differently.
Yes, we do.
And therefore, we might be able to get extra reward for those possibilities. And we know, for example, that the alts tend to outperform once risk taking is established within Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Because what we're doing is going out the risk curve. So, for example, normals in financial markets, what happens, let's say you're a credit investor, you own single A equity credit, then you buy mm-hmm. some triple B's, and then you buy some junk bonds to juice your returns. And you'll hold those junk bonds more cautiously and will get rid of them quicker than your core single A's. It's the same thing. It's mm-hmm. just curve. And people don't understand it. And we also understand that there's a bunch of people who really want to protect the network. And yep. that's, we can probably benefit from that too.
Absolutely. And I think that is a really constructive analogy on how you actually describing that. I don't think I've heard anybody say that the way that you have thus far. And so I think that's really powerful. I'm mindful of time. You obviously are quite busy these days. Would love for just a little bit of fun on the side, because you have given us a ton of knowledge here and some great insights. I've also gotten to know you a little bit personally on the fact that you are quite the music buff. And so would love to hear anything that you are currently listening to at the beginning of 2021. How are you unwinding at the end of the day after a long, busy day?
Okay, so I'm just going to my Apple Music app and looking at some of the things that I've bought recently or have started playing. I've gone back in time and started listening to The Specials. Ooh. The Specials were a ska band from the UK from the late 70s. Mm-hmm. Why I started listening to The Specials, A, they're amazing. Mm-hmm. B, I live in the Caribbean, and they were basically a bunch of English guys plus Jamaican guys, first generation, living in Coventry in England mm-hmm. during a really, really, really politicized, shitty time. Mm-hmm. And the music speaks of that. And mm-hmm. it speaks of today. And it's fantastic. And it's this kind of ska music, but beneath it, it's all about the kind of misery of life in England in the late 70s mm-hmm. and the aggression that came out of it. So that's one thing I've been listening to that I've really enjoyed coming back into. Mm-hmm. Let's have a look. I'm a huge David Bowie fan. I rediscovered Bowie's set at Glastonbury in 2000.
Oh, wow.
Which is one of the most famous sets of all time.
Yep.
Arguably the greatest set in the history of Glastonbury. So that was really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. Let me see. I'm trying to now get my Apple Music app up while we do this, because I can't see all my music because the Sonos doesn't show me all of the... let's have a look. Yeah, here we go. Other things. Something really unique is music I discovered last year. It's not the easiest music to listen to. I saw them live at the Bowery in New York and they were unbelievable. Okay. It's something that's going to be something huge.
Okay.
People were looking at each other. There was a lot of music insiders at the event, looking at each other, shaking their heads, going, wow, these guys are something special. It's like a new Radiohead, but it's not Radiohead. They're called Black Midi, M-I-D-I.
Okay.
And the album's called Schlagenheim. S-C-H-L-A-G-E-N-H-E-I-M. So that's really good. And then I have also been listening to some UK kind of chill out music that was kind of urban and cool from a while ago. And it's an album called Untrue by Burial.
Very, very cool stuff. I have to check out that Black MIDI one. That sounds very, very cool. And may I say, just as a little bit of a fun joke-ism, you're a bloody wanker because I gave you my DJ mix and I know you're a big DJ head, so you have not listed it as your top four.
Yeah, I've not been listening to a lot of dance music right now.
You bloody Muppet, as you would say back in your own home back in the UK.
It just doesn't feel like the time to listen to dance music.
Yes, I know.
It feels like it's the time to listen to something. Don't forget, I lived for 10 years
in Ibiza,
in a beach town overlooking Ibiza.
Yep.
So I was on the main coast of Spain.
Yep.
And so that whole Ibiza dance music was a whole amazing period of time for me.
Yep.
Where you live in the sun, life is inexpensive, life is fun, quality life is amazing. Spain was incredible place to be.
Yep.
And that was an amazing period in time. Feels like we're in a different moment in time. So
I agree.
I'm also here in the Caribbean now. So I'm doing a lot of listening to music from this region as well, just to kind of get my roots here.
As I said, Raul was always someone that I know is a music head. So he's gotten some good suggestions there. So take a look at it. We'll obviously make sure that everyone has in the notes to go to Real Vision for them to take a look at the amazing content that you have all been creating over the years. And now, especially with your work on digital assets. So I will make sure everyone goes there. If anyone wants to give you a follow on Twitter or any other kind of mediums, you want to drop them just your Twitter handle.
Yeah, I mean, the two easiest things to do is one, find me on Twitter at Raul, R-A-O-U-L-G-M-I. And also, Real Vision Crypto, it's our entire free crypto channel. So you've got no reason not to. If you're interested in all of this space, there is everybody on it from every single part of it, from Bitcoin maximalists to people working on the weirdest, wonkiest projects. It'll give you a great understanding of what's going on. And it's free. So realvisioncrypto.com.
Awesome. Raul, thank you for coming on. Please, everyone, check out what he's just alluded to. And hopefully, maybe we can have you back on in 6 months or 12 months. Maybe the world is a little bit better. We'll see. But for now, thank you. Good luck. Be well. Godspeed.
And to you as well. And to everybody listening.
Thanks for listening in to BaseLayer. If you like the show and all the different guests that we've brought on, please give a like and subscribe on Apple or Spotify or wherever you do listen to the podcast. Also, if you want to have a conversation or reach out to me, you can reach me out on Twitter at David J. Nage and let's talk there. Or also you can find me on LinkedIn and I look forward to having great conversations with you all about digital assets. This podcast is presented by Blockworks Group, one of the best digital asset event and media production companies that I know of. For exclusive content and events that provide insight into digital assets, visit them at blockworksgroup.io. You won't be disappointed.